This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello there. I appreciate you tuning in. I'm Joel Hilliker. Today we're going to talk about how America's economy is being transformed by a little virus called COVID-19. There's a real battle taking place right now for the future of national economies, and it's especially fierce in America. This nation is the epitome of free markets versus a centralized command economy. And how well do you understand the difference between these two economic models? It's an excellent time to get educated because you need to understand what is at stake. America's economy is being rapidly transformed. You can pretty well guarantee it's never going back to the way it was. And there are people who've been wanting to transform it for some time. They want to strip power from the private sector and from individuals and concentrate it in the hands of the government. And they are really seizing this opportunity to advance this cause. So we'll talk about this in our first segment today, why this is such a serious cause for concern. President Donald Trump has been trying to withdraw America from the Middle East. He's pulling out of Iraq, out of Afghanistan. There's an indication he wants to pull out of the Sinai Peninsula. And this would have serious repercussions for Israel. In our second segment, we'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about the importance of America's presence in the Sinai as a buffer for the Jewish state and what it would mean if the U.S. were no longer there. And we'll hear about a plague that has received very little attention in the midst of coronavirus, a terrible locust plague that is ravaging Africa, the worst in decades. It's already hit Kenya, Ethiopia, and Somalia badly, and it threatens to spread throughout North Africa and the Middle East. It's got implications for food production, and even geopolitical and specific prophetic effects as well. We'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Daniel DeSanto about this story. And I'll conclude the program today by giving you some advice on how to stay strong in times of stress. Let's start, though, by talking about coronavirus and America's economy. These are rough times. Unemployment is through the roof. Businesses across the world are suffering. Obviously, there's a major health crisis, but there's a far bigger economic crisis. You know, the last 25 years have seen tremendous improvements in global poverty thanks to the increase in free markets and capitalism around the world. It's brought millions of people into prosperity that they've never enjoyed before. Now we see this progress severely threatened. We're all feeling the effects of this crisis, but nobody is feeling it worse than the people in the poorer countries. This is from a Spectator USA article from May 13th. It says the United Nations forecasts that even if the world economy rebounds in the second half of the year, the economic downturn would increase the numbers in extreme poverty by anything from 84 million to 132 million. The recession would reverse years of progress in the fight against child mortality in the developing world. The UN's World Food Program predicts that by the end of the year, the numbers facing acute hunger will double to 265 million. These are staggering figures. If this were to be the result of a natural disaster, it would be worldwide news. Now it's just seen as a footnote in the side effects of lockdown. Now note that these are not the effects of the virus. These are the effects of the lockdown from the virus. And this highlights a very important point. This is a spectacular example of a fundamental flaw with human beings. How do we solve problems? And can we solve them in a way that doesn't create more problems? Everybody can recognize problems, but what do you do about them? Far too often, as we devise solutions, we fail to correctly diagnose the problem. We're only seeing a part of the picture. We're failing to grasp the full reality. And we end up applying solutions that create more problems than they solve. Now, there's a specific fundamental reason for that, which I will explain. But look squarely at what's happening here and the solutions that are being implemented by our governments. And I want to focus specifically on America and on the economic side of things. Coronavirus has shut down the economy. Production has stopped. The ability of people to do their jobs has been frozen. So you have mass unemployment and businesses failing, cratered economic activity, serious problems. And there's a lot of pressure on the government to do something, bail us out, do it now, which is understandable. But there's also a danger that in our urgency, we're going to make some serious mistakes. Haste makes waste, as Benjamin Franklin said. Now, first of all, there's a lot of evidence this is self-induced. It's made worse by our poor health, and then it's exacerbated by politicians and leaders making bad decisions. It certainly is a curse that we would not be experiencing if we were living the right way and we were being blessed by God. But because of this virus, suddenly the economy has tanked, and a lot of people who were taking care of themselves just fine have been told to stay home, stop working. Don't worry, the government will take care of you. And we have to look at why government officials are saying this. For decades, there has been a movement in America to undermine free markets and to move toward collectivism and a command economy. And this has really intensified in recent years with the rise of Bernie Sanders, the liberalization or the Democratic Party moving so much further to the left. This movement among young people who somehow believe that government is the solution to all our problems. They want free education, free health care, guaranteed income, whether you work or not. They want everything provided for them. There are many people who are looking at what's happening right now, the problems that are created by these lockdowns, and they're saying, see, that this proves capitalism doesn't work. They're surveying the scene, they're seeing all these needy people, and they're viewing this as a phenomenal opportunity. The Democratic Socialists of America, this is America's largest socialist organization. It has about 50,000 members as of a year and a half ago, and it's drawing more and more young people all the time. This is the party of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Rashida Tlaib. They support eco-socialism, socialist feminism, anti-imperialism. They say they're anti-fascist, but they're pro-Marxist. And they definitely advocate stripping power from individuals in the private sector and shifting it to the government. They put this on their website just a week ago, a week and a half ago. This is May 7th, called May Dispatch, Crisis and Opportunity. And it was written by Maria Svart. She's the DSA National Director. She begins with a quote from Milton Friedman, and she describes him as an enemy. But the quote says, "Only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change." And she says that the far right is moving quickly to take advantage of this crisis, but she says the socialists have to move faster. And she really does want to produce real change. She says the Bernie Sanders campaign and the multiracial working class movement behind him has brought democratic socialist ideas back into the center of political conversation. Our job as socialists is to keep moving us in that direction, to build a new world on the ashes of the old. She says, if there is now a crisis of legitimacy of the old way of doing things, there is an opportunity to create permanent shifts. And note this, she says, we see this already where low-wage workers receive unemployment checks higher than old poverty wages, and where millions of people lost employer-based health care overnight and are now adrift in a pandemic and looking to Medicare for all. So she sees these as really good things, people getting more from the government with an unemployment check than they were getting on their job, people having to use government health care rather than private health insurance. Now, a normal thinking person would see it as a problem that someone can actually make more money from the government for not working than they can by working. But she sees it as a wonderful thing. She writes, between seeing that workers really are essential for human survival, yet the bosses still see us as expendable, it has become clear that we have nothing to lose but our chains. And that, of course, is a quote directly from the Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx. But she says, who stands in the way of Medicare for all, of universal rent control, living wages, workers deciding to produce the ventilators we need? Who stands in the way, she says, the owning class, not the working class. Large majorities of the 95% of people sheltering at home want to stay there, and for those who cannot, strike activity is picking up. We must organize ourselves and fight. So this group calls themselves socialists, but this is just flat-out communist thinking. It may be only 50,000 people who belong to this specific organization, but this is the type of thinking that you hear more and more animating what the Democrats are doing and the way that they're responding to coronavirus and the discussion that you hear taking place in the mainstream media. There are a lot of people who see this crisis as an opportunity to advance this economic agenda. And they really are making significant progress. And all of their proposals get back to empowering government, taking more from people and giving it to the government to redistribute as they see fit. I'll just give you another example. This is an article in The Guardian by Mariana Mazzucato. She's a professor of economics at the University College London. The title of this article, The COVID-19 Crisis is a Chance to Do Capitalism Differently. And she talks about how this crisis has exposed the lack of a safety net, she says, and protection for working peoples in societies with rising inequality. She says, now we have an opportunity to use this crisis as a way to understand how to do capitalism differently. This requires a rethink of what governments are for. Rather than simply fixing market failures when they arise, they should move towards actively shaping and creating markets that deliver sustainable and inclusive growth. Now, it's important to remember, governments operate at the public expense. Government takes decision-making and they take power and they take resources away from private individuals and they concentrate it in the hands of the ruling class. You know, it's amazing how much they criticize the 1% when that 1% is outside of the government, but they have unlimited amount of faith in the 1% within the government. They treat them like they are above reproach and they can't make any mistakes. They're practically infallible. All of the people who are advocating for these policies have tremendous faith in government as long as it's themselves. So this Guardian article talks about how they can ensure prices are fair, patents are not abused, medicine supply is safeguarded, and profits are reinvested back into innovation rather than siphoned out to shareholders. So as long as it's the government that's investing, then it's all going to work out beautifully. Private investment is somehow corrupt. Government investment is free of self-interest. She writes, as companies from airlines to retail come asking for bailouts and other types of assistance, it is important to resist simply handing out money. Conditions can be attached to make sure that bailouts are structured in ways that transform the sectors they're saving so that they become a part of a new economy, one that is focused on the Green New Deal strategy of lowering carbon emissions while also investing in workers and making sure they can adapt to new technologies. It must be done now while government has the upper hand, she writes. while they're handing out all of this money, they need to take advantage of this and make sure that they structure things the way they want it done. She says, we can use this moment to bring a stakeholder approach to the center of capitalism. Let's not let this crisis go to waste. Let me play a clip from former Democrat presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. He said this past Sunday on ABC's This Week.
And I also think, George, to tell you the truth, that if there is any silver lining in the midst of this terrible, terrible and unprecedented moment in American history in terms of the economy, in terms of the pandemic, it is that maybe we start rethinking some fundamental tenets about the way our government and society works. And we should ask ourselves, among other things, is healthcare a human right that all of us deserve because we're human beings? Or is it simply a healthcare benefit that somehow we lose when we lose our jobs? There's a lot to be done. And if there's anything that I hope we learn out of this horribly painful experience, is that maybe we create an economy and a government that works for all, not just the few and wealthy campaign contributors.
So the Green New Deal people want to ban gasoline use. They want to get the cars off the roads, or at least the gasoline burning cars. They want to shut down the airline industry. So here we are. The coronavirus has decimated the travel industry. People aren't driving. Gasoline demand has plummeted. The airline industry has tanked. Nobody's flying. Airlines are slashing their flights. How can the Green New Deal proponents not be excited? They are thrilled at how much less carbon is being emitted. And who'd have thought how quickly these kinds of drastic measures should be enacted to save the planet? Of course, it's not quite far enough as far as they're concerned. This global shutdown is projected to suppress carbon emissions by only 6%. Some analysts say they need to drop close to 8% to beat climate change. So we're getting there, but we have to make even greater sacrifices. And of course, we have to make the changes permanent as far as they're concerned. This is from a climate activist, Eric Holthaus. He tweeted, "This is what rapid, far-reaching, and unprecedented changes in all aspects of society looks like. We're doing it. It's possible." Spanish scientist Martin Lopez Corredora said, "Neither Greenpeace nor Greta Thunberg nor any other individual or collective organization have achieved so much in favor of the health of the planet in such a short time. A miracle happened. It is certainly not very good for the economy in general, but it is fantastic for the environment." So this is the way they're viewing what has happened. You know, as people are out of work, the people who have been pushing measures to have economic security for everyone, even people who can't work or don't want to work, suddenly you have millions of people who are in that category, a perfect opportunity to test out ideas like universal basic income to get more people on the government payroll. They really are seizing this opportunity. Last week, the Democrats unveiled a $3 trillion relief package. The $2 trillion package they already passed, that was the largest relief bill in history. This one would surpass that by half again as much. It would give $1 trillion to state and local governments, about $200 billion for hazard pay for essential workers, $175 billion in rent, mortgage, and utility assistance, $75 billion for COVID testing, up to $6,000 more per household in America, extending unemployment benefits, giving subsidies for people who lose their health coverage. This is what they are doing with this opportunity. And they keep telling people, stay home. Don't take the risk of going to work. Let the government take care of you. This is collectivism, socialism, communism. They want to make it so that people aren't allowed to take care of themselves. They have to rely on the government to provide for them. And once you get into that pattern of dependency, it is extremely difficult to break. people put more and more faith in government. And every time something goes wrong, they hold politicians responsible. And the more we do that, the more politicians are taking advantage of the opportunity to take away our liberty and to put people in a position where they are absolutely dependent on the government. Now, why do these solutions fail? Why do they create more problems than they solve? The reason, the simple reason, the fundamental reason is that they ignore God. They ignore God's law. God has an economic system that works. He has an economic system that helps everyone to enjoy prosperity, that helps poor people, that helps those who slip through the safety net, if you want to put it that way. He has an economic system based on individual responsibility and private charity. God created the family to encourage individual responsibility and industry and productivity and to ensure that everyone's needs are taken care of. And God even has a limited system of centrally run welfare for those who fall outside that economic and social structure of the family. He has a system, and however we deviate from that divine system and we try to make things work apart from that design, our efforts are doomed to fail. The side effects are far worse than the problem that they're trying to solve. We rob people of personal dignity. We empower and we expand government in unhealthy ways. We introduce massive economic distortions. We create a climate in which corruption can breed. This is a tremendous lesson that we need to take from what's happening in the world today. God's solutions work. Human solutions always tend to create more problems than they solve. Human solutions that ignore God's law always fail. Take this opportunity to study God's system, God's economic system, God's law, God's way of solving the problems that plague mankind. It's a study that you'll find richly rewarding.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
America's presence in the Middle East has helped to preserve something of an uneasy status quo for several decades. But Bible prophecy says some big changes are ahead, and America withdrawing from the region could do a lot to accelerate the fulfillment of those prophecies, as we will now hear in this report from Brent Noctegal.
For the past 40 years, the peace treaty with Egypt has provided the foundation of Israel's security doctrine. All of Israel's nation-threatening wars of 48, 67, and 73 took place before the peace treaty with Egypt was enacted in 1979. Though there have been many wars between Israel and its northern neighbors in the time since, Egypt has remained out of the fight. And without the worry of supplying forces to its southern flank, Israel has been able to focus on defending the north of Israel from Iran and its proxies. In effect, the peace pact with Egypt has prevented Israel from having to worry about a serious multi-front war. The simple quid pro quo was this: Israel gives the Sinai Peninsula back to Egypt, and then Egypt promises not to station its troops in the Sinai. The Sinai would become a buffer between Israeli and Egyptian forces, and if Egypt ever decided to break the treaty and storm towards Israel, the IDF would have time to mobilize before Egypt reached Israel's population centers. But what would happen if Israel had to once again contend with an enemy on its southern border? What would happen if hostile forces, perhaps linked to Iran, were operating in the Sinai Peninsula as they do in southern Lebanon or the Syrian Golan Heights? The result would be a return to the dangerous reality Israel faced before the peace treaty with Egypt. While there's no discussion between Israel and Egypt about tearing up the document right now, decisions being made in Washington, D.C. might actually have the same effect. Behind closed doors, Egypt's government under Abdel Fattah el-Sisi maintain a friendly working relationship with Israel. His government continues to abide by the Israeli-Egypt peace treaty of 1979, just as the governments of Anwar Sadat and Hosni Mubarak have before him. Israel routinely works with Egypt's military to stop weapons smuggling to Hamas in the Gaza Strip. In 2011, Israel also backed the Egyptian military's request to increase its troop presence in the Sinai Peninsula to fight against Islamic State forces taking refuge there. As part of the treaty, Egyptian forces had been limited in their access to the Sinai. Instead, a peacekeeping force known as the Multinational Force and Observers would be located in the Sinai and monitor the border between Egypt and Israel. As the mediator of the peace deal, American forces would provide the largest number of troops in that peacekeeping force. When the Arab Spring took hold of Egypt in 2011 and 12, jihadis used the largely ungoverned space of Sinai as a breeding ground for terrorist attacks against Egypt and Israel. Eventually, a branch of the Islamic State was established in the Sinai. Responding to the situation, the Egyptian government asked Israel if it could change part of the treaty and increase its forces in the Sinai to combat terrorism. Israel acquiesced to the request, partly because a destabilized Sinai was a danger to its own safety, and partly because the continued presence of the multinational force and observers in the Sinai could observe that the Egyptian military stuck to fighting terrorists rather than repurposing its forces to threaten Israel. Egypt's fight against Sinai terrorists has continued into 2020, but now the United States is considering removing all of its forces from the MFO. And if the 450 American troops currently stationed in the Sinai leave, it's possible that the other members of the 1,100-member force would leave too. The United States is considering the move because Egypt and Israel's relations are quite strong, and it considers its troop presence unnecessary, and therefore an unnecessary cost. U.S. defense officials told the Wall Street Journal on May 7th that Secretary of Defense Mark Esper, quote, feels the U.S. military effort in northern Sinai isn't the best use of the department resources or worth the risk to troops stationed there. Egypt and Israel have maintained a durable peace for 4 decades, end quote. Esper is correct that the border is relatively peaceful right now, but the United States' withdrawal will undermine one of the most important aspects of the peace deal between Egypt and Israel. Egyptian troops were never intended to be inside the Sinai Peninsula, as their closer proximity to Israel poses an immediate threat to Israeli security. Israel only accepted the influx of Egyptian troops into the Sinai because the United States, a friendly Israeli ally, could provide oversight and monitor the Egyptian forces. Now that the U.S. might leave, Israel will be left without the deterring effect of a U.S. presence. It would be unfair to demand that Egypt withdraw from the Sinai while it's in the midst of fighting its war against terrorism there. However, if Egyptian forces don't leave the Sinai when the U.S. vacates, Israel will lose the most important strategic outcome of the 1978 peace agreement, the Sinai buffer zone between Egypt and Israel's population centers. For the moment, Egypt and Israel's security needs a line in the Sinai Peninsula, and so Israel is not overly concerned with the presence of Sisi's forces so close. However, as we have witnessed in the Arab Spring itself, Egyptian politics are unstable. Trumpet editor Gerald Flurry has forecast a radical change in Egyptian politics in the near future, and that change will likely be similar to what took place during the Arab Spring in 2011 and 12, which brought down the Egyptian strongman Hosni Mubarak, a strong believer in the Israeli-Egyptian peace pact. After Mubarak's fall, Egyptians voted in what many consider Egypt's only free election in its 5,000-year history, and the result was that they handed parliament to the Muslim Brotherhood. 6 months later, they elected their new president, Mohamed Morsi, again from the Muslim Brotherhood. Morsi's campaign launched in 2012 with the Egyptian cleric Safwat Hegezi telling an enthusiastic crowd with Morsi in the front row, quote, "We can see how the dream of the Islamic Caliphate is being realized, Allah willing, by Dr. Mohamed Morsi. The capital of the Caliphate will be in Jerusalem, Allah willing." Thousands cheered and chanted at the time, "Morsi will liberate Gaza tomorrow. Millions of martyrs march towards Jerusalem." End quote. "Come on, you lovers of martyrdom. You're all Hamas." End quote. Now, while Egyptian rule under Mohamed Morsi only lasted for a short time, the vision of Islamic rule in Egypt was realized, and a return to the Muslim Brotherhood rule inside Egypt poses a continuous threat to Israel's security. And that threat becomes more serious, again, if Egyptian forces are already in the Sinai, and there is no United States to deter them from action against Israel. At which point, Israel's peace treaty with Egypt will be nothing more than a piece of paper. As Mr. Flurry has explained in his booklet, The King of the South, a radical change is coming in Egyptian politics which will see the return to Islamic rule. That forecast is based on a latter-day prophecy found in the Book of Daniel and shows that Iran is going to lead an Islamic alliance known as the King of the South, and that it will be allied with Egypt. And without that prophetic understanding, it would be easy to justify United States' move from Sinai. However, knowing that Egypt is going to be part of this Iranian-led alliance shows that the United States' decision could have far greater consequences than intended. For a complete understanding of how the coming Egyptian-Iranian alliance will factor into the timeline of latter-day events, please request our free book, The King of the South.
Well, thank you very much for that, Brent. This is an interesting case where if you're just looking at the facts on the ground, you're looking at why America is making this decision. And there are obviously a lot of pressures on America right now economically. It kind of makes sense that they would decide that things are good enough there for them to be able to pull out. But when you look at it from a prophetic standpoint, it looks very, very different.
Yeah, and I think many people that would read the article, listen to this segment, might think we are blowing it out of proportion, what the United States is doing. They only have 450 troops there. It's not a huge contingent. And you have this really long, durable peace that's existed between Israel and Egypt for over four decades now. And so you would think that this is the kind of the easiest decision the United States would have to remove forces from a certain part of the world. It would be from here. So that's why it looks like that's what they want to do, to remove the forces from here. There's probably going to be other situations where the United States is moving forces from the Middle East. So that makes sense for them to pull out. But if we look at it in terms of biblical prophecy, we know that this border between Israel and Egypt is going to become a lot hotter, especially because we anticipate an Iranian entrenchment there in a relationship with Egypt coming together to form an alliance. And so if you can imagine what's taking place right now on Israel's northern border and the border with Syria, you have Iran and its proxies there, and Hezbollah fighting against Israel and having so many missiles there in their arsenal against Israel. We don't think about that taking place in the southern border, but because we know that Iran is going to ally with Egypt in the future, we can expect that type of danger. And if you're in Israel, it would be far better for there to be a peace agreement, not watered down, still in effect, that had removed Egyptian forces back to the out of the Sinai Peninsula. But there's no way that that Egypt is going to remove its forces right now out of the Sinai Peninsula, and Israel wouldn't want them to, even if the U.S. removed, because it's a hotbed for terrorists right now in the Sinai. Every week you've got a new attack that takes place in the Sinai against Egyptian forces, against civilians. There's another one yesterday, four civilians killed in the Sinai by these terrorists. And so it's really caught Israel between a rock and a hard spot, and also the Egyptians. What are the Egyptians meant to do? Are they meant to say to Israel, yep, the Americans are gone. We know that they were here to kind of oversee our increased forces in the Sinai Peninsula, which was against the peace treaty, but now they're gone, but we need to be here. Are they going to say that we'll go back to the other side of the Sinai Peninsula? No, they're not. And so what happens then, Bible prophecy speaking now, when Egypt does take that radical turn and you already have Egyptian forces right on the border with Israel, rather than the Sinai Peninsula acting as that buffer as it was intended under the Egyptian-Israeli peace deal.
We don't have much time to talk about it, but the peace plan that the United States is putting forward regarding Israel, it is something that has stirred up quite a lot of discussion within the region. And one of the individuals who's made some comments that do raise eyebrows is the Jordanian King Abdullah. And this is another situation where you have what has been very stable relations between Israel and Jordan, but he's intimating that this peace process could create some real problems. And again, looking at this from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, we see that this could really become a major problem for Israel.
Right. He came out with an interview with Spiegel, the German newspaper Spiegel or magazine, and said that if Israel goes ahead with this, quote, it would lead to a massive conflict with the Hashemite kingdom of Jordan. He said that this week. And Jordan's the only other Middle Eastern nation with a peace treaty with Israel. Since 94, Israel's not had to worry about that border. And here you've got the king there. He's saying this. Of course, he wants the relationship with Israel to continue just because it safeguards a lot of that relationship does safeguard his access to gas and access to water and a lot of things. He benefits a lot from it. But he has a massive Palestinian population that doesn't like Israel, and that his citizens, they don't like Israel, and they don't want Israel to go through with this annexation. And so he has to come out and say that. However, he does have a lot of support for him, for let's say how upset he is over this peace deal, because Europeans are very much with him. The Abdullah said in this interview with Spiegel that Angela Merkel understands his position. He said that Germany understands what the right decision is on the Israeli-Palestinian question. They are working together through this, and that's what we expect in terms of biblical prophecy, is for Jordan to actually become more antagonistic towards Israel and to have a closer relationship with Europe going forward. And so it's interesting. At the same time, you have the two peace treaties that Israel has with two different states in the Middle East, and both of them right now seem under threat.
Well, I do hope that you're able to give us more information about that situation with Jordan in the time ahead. We'll watch that, but we thank you very much for bringing this situation in Egypt to our attention. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about the potential for America to reduce or eliminate its presence in the Sinai Peninsula and the effects that that would have on Israel. He's working on an article about this subject. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Thank you so much, Brent.
No problem.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
A locust is a fairly small critter, but put 70 million of them together in a swarm and you have a uniquely devastating force. A plague of locusts sounds like something from the Book of Exodus, but it is happening right now, as we will now hear in this report from Daniel DeSanto.
Compared to common headlines about coronavirus and the oil crash, the recent surge of locusts plaguing East Africa has received little attention. But this could easily prove to be one of the most transformative events for Africa and eventually for many other places in the world as well. Currently, Kenya is experiencing the worst wave of locusts in 70 years, according to the UN Food and Agriculture Association. They reported that on January 20th. Ethiopia and Somalia as well are severely affected by this outbreak of swarms of locusts. The continent of Africa is experiencing what the Food and Agriculture Administration calls an upsurge in locusts. Now, this is just one stage removed from what they would call a plague. So this is a pretty serious event for Africa. But it won't be serious just for Africa. It's also going to affect major parts of the Middle East. It's forecast to spread further to the west and north in Africa, And it's going to change a lot about the balance of power in Africa and the Middle East as well. It can certainly contribute to major changes in the balance of power for Africa and the Middle East. First of all, we have to understand how destructive locusts can be. One adult can eat the equivalent of its own body weight in vegetation every day. Swarms can grow to the size of New York City or London. So imagine some of the world's biggest cities absolutely covered in locusts, in dense clouds of locusts. Now, these insects can ruin 300 million pounds of crops in a single day. A modest group of them can contain 40 million of the insect. There may be swarms of up to 70 million as well. In one day, that swarm can eat the same volume of vegetables as 35,000 average humans. These are not just your average small little aphids or little insects that eat a little bit and then go away. These insects devour everything in their path. Now, we wrote about this on thetrumpet.com back in February, and at that time, farmers were hoping that by this time of year, the plague would be greatly decreased, if not wiped out, by drier weather coming in as summer begins. Sadly, that's not the case right now, though, for Africa's farmers. That group of locusts multiplied, and it has actually increased beyond what anyone expected, creating this major crisis. Now, it's increased mainly because the weather didn't become drier. Wet weather continued. Locusts are also able to multiply by a factor of 20 every 3 months. So from the time we wrote about this in February until about this time right now, the locusts that were there at the time have multiplied by 20 times over. The timing of this newest infestation is also very important. Last year, the locusts came at a time when most of the crops had already been gathered in and harvested. This year, they came in mid-March, and in Africa, mid-March is the start of the growing season. So as those plants grew up, they were devoured. Now, this is compounding a problem which already exists in Africa, that of food insecurity, or simply shortage of food not reaching the people who need it. The UN estimated that as many as 25 million East Africans will suffer from food shortages during this year. Roughly 13 million of them already suffer from food insecurity, and that's in Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia, Djibouti, and Eritrea. So 13 million in just those countries already suffer from it, and of course, the plague of locusts is going to significantly add to that. Now, what does this plague mean on a regional, continental, or even global level? Of course, this is a severe problem for Africans. Everyday Africans are going to suffer. They're going to see food prices rising. The farmers will see losses in revenues. But what does this mean for the region and for the balance of power there? Well, nations that rely on agriculture are going to be plunged into a crisis. Almost 70% of East Africans work in agriculture. 48% of all Africans rely on agriculture to earn a living. Furthermore, about half of all Africans choose to go into agriculture upon entering the workforce. So these are major sources of income for African nations, which are literally being eaten up in front of their eyes. And of course, with a decline in revenues, with rising food prices in urban areas as well, comes the potential for social unrest. The vice president of Moody's Corporation, Kevin Dalrymple, told CNBC that rising food prices from a prolonged shortage of key crops fuels the potential for social unrest across East Africa, a region where we already assess political risks as elevated and the ingredients for potential social unrest prevalent. Moody's warned that this will test the capacity for East Africa's food storage and supply chain as well, just to be able to supply food during this shock. So many financial analysts see that there is a potential for social unrest because of these issues with falling revenues and then rising food prices. And with social unrest, as history, recent history even in Africa and the Middle East has taught us, often come violent uprisings, even giving radical Islamists and terrorists the opportunity to seize parts of countries or even topple the government in some cases. For example, Somalia. The country has battled al-Shabaab for over a decade, and they've battled radical Islamic extremism for even longer than that. The country suffered civil war through the 90s into the 2000s, and now they are suffering from multiple problems, and they're still suffering from al-Shabaab's terrorism. That group claims multiple areas of the country and even carried out an attack in 2017, which killed 500 people in one day. So this is a problem which has not gone away. And although U.S. airstrikes in that country have increased, the problem has certainly not disappeared. Now the country faces the potential for rising food prices due to this swarm of locusts coming from Kenya and entering the country. Ethiopia is another country being severely impacted by these locusts, and it shares a 1,000-mile-long border with Somalia. Now, of course, the locusts will be migrating over that border, but as the U.S. State Department points out, so do terrorists. The terrorists also come over that border into Ethiopia, which is a predominantly Christian country, to carry out their attacks. Now, the last thing that Ethiopia needs right now is even more instability and crises. So far, for all of Africa, especially for East Africa, 2020 has been a year of crises, a year of instability, of turmoil, and it may become a year of major change as well. All of these shocks to the economy, with the oil price crash, coronavirus, and now the locust plague causing the potential for social unrest and even radical Islamic infiltration, all of these fit into a forecast the Trumpet has been making for years. Editor-in-chief of The Trumpet, Gerald Fleury, wrote in an April 2011 Trumpet edition that the Bible forecasts Ethiopia will actually come under the influence of radical Islam. Now, at the time he wrote that especially, that sounded like almost a ridiculous statement. People could look at Ethiopia and see that it was a Christian-majority country, and it didn't seem like radical Islam was anywhere near able to overcome the government and just take control. However, it's worth looking at current events to see what direction that has gone since that forecast was made. David Shin is an expert on Horn of Africa, and he wrote that while Ethiopia does have the advantage of an effective and tough security apparatus that can probably counter any challenge posed by a Muslim splinter group, there is broad disaffection in Ethiopia's large Muslim community, and that is another matter altogether. So Ethiopia has, since that time Mr. Fleury wrote that article, seen increasing clashes between its Christian majority and its strong Muslim minority. There have been burnings of churches and synagogues, and of course deaths on both sides, as clashes have intensified. But how were we able to make such a forecast back in 2011, back at a time when, factually speaking, it wouldn't look like radical Islam would even have a chance to come into Ethiopia? Well, you may have heard that the Bible prophesies about food shortages in the time leading up to Christ's return. And of course, this is true. It does. It does prophesy about famines. But it also prophesies about certain nations falling into the grip of radical Islam. One of those prophecies is Daniel 11:40. This describes a military clash involving two major powers. One of these major powers is the King of the South. And in our booklet by that same name, the King of the South booklet by Mr. Fleury, we identify the King of the South as radical Islam together with its terrorist proxies. Now, that prophecy in Daniel 11:40 says that radical Islam and Iran are going to clash with the King of the North. And of course, we also identify the King of the North in our booklet, who we show to be Europe, led by Germany. Now, that prophecy shows that this King of the North will strike radical Islam. So Europe is going to strike the terrorists, both the head of them in Iran and also Iran's proxies throughout Africa and the Middle East. And it shows that certain countries are going to be overrun. In verse 43, it says that the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. And in other words, that means they shall be conquered by this King of the North. Now, if these countries like Libya and Ethiopia are going to be conquered by the King of the North, logically, they would already be overrun by radical Islam when this prophecy is fulfilled. This is why the Trumpet is watching instability throughout Africa and also in the Middle East. As locusts add to the woes of African nations and add to the risks that nations and entire regimes will collapse, as they add to the risk of social unrest and to the risk that radical Islamists could seize upon that social unrest for their own gain, the trumpet has been continuing to monitor this situation because of this prophecy. Locust plagues might seem like a distant problem, especially if you're from North America or Europe. You may not have seen a swarm of locusts in person, but this is going to have major economic impacts and political and even geopolitical impacts in the very near future. So along with coronavirus and the oil shock, locusts causing instability in Africa is definitely a story that you should continue to watch. And if you want to read more about how radical Islam is prophesied to gain the upper hand over certain countries in Africa, such as Ethiopia, you can read our free booklet, The King of the South.
Thank you very much for that, Daniel. So can you tell us where they're projecting these locusts will go next?
Well, they're projecting a number of places. And of course, that does vary based on what weather actually occurs. But the main places we should be looking at here are, first of all, the Sahel region. So that's just below the North African countries. So just below Algeria and Libya. So that would be countries like Chad, Mauritania. The ones you don't hear about as often, but that is a place that's very much plagued by terrorism and already suffers from food shortages and poverty, so it would only worsen the situation there. There is also a forecast that those locusts could spread, of course, to North Africa, which is, it's a very oil-dependent area as well. There are also forecasts, well, they have already actually spread to Iran, and they're forecasting it could go as far as Syria or potentially, if it were to continue, go on to Lebanon and Israel.
Iran has already been hit pretty hard by COVID-19 and economic problems. What sort of effects would it have if it did spread up into those areas?
Well, if Iran's food production is going to be decreased even more, that would only raise prices. And of course, consumers are not going to be happy. There's going to be growing discontent with Iran's government. And usually when a dictatorial regime has growing discontent from its citizens, it turns to other forms of getting approval, such as conducting military adventures or creating an incident. This was also seen, for example, with Crimea when President Putin's approval ratings were really low.
Right.
He staged an attack on Crimea and then his approval ratings shot up. So Iran might try to do something similar as well.
Well, we do appreciate that very much. We've been talking with trumpet writer Daniel DeSanto about the locust plague sweeping through parts of Africa right now. He's written an article about this called Locusts, the World's Other Epidemic. You can find that on thetrumpet.com. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
Do you ever feel stressed out? You have a big project overdue at work, the water damage under the bathroom sink is getting worse, and then your child gets sick. How do you handle those times? Here's something Gerald Fleury wrote in his booklet, How to Be an Overcomer. There's a lot of stress in war. People have broken down from that stress. But did you know that real fighters almost never get stressed out? Proverbs 24, verse 10 says, if you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small. So how about it? Are you a real fighter, or is your strength small? We've all seen people not handle stress the right way and break down. If you're watching what's happening in the world today, you know times are coming that are going to get far more stressful than they are now. When things go wrong, we want to be people who can be relied on. How can you survive stress, even thrive under pressure? Well, I want to show you how to do so through good health. Realize that stress isn't bad of itself. We need it in order to perform our best. Only the dead have no worries. Having problems and worries is a part of life. We have to learn how to handle them skillfully. Stress is just your body's response to a challenge or a threat when it feels you need more strength, more stamina, more alertness. Your heart rate increases, adrenaline and other hormones are released into your bloodstream that get you ready for action. That can be really helpful. You face a challenge, that stress response can improve your performance and help you handle the pressure better. However, another effect is that during stressful periods, your immune system, your digestion, and a few other things are repressed so the body can deal with the perceived immediate danger. Over time, with high and frequent hyperstress, our body functions are weakened, and we become vulnerable to viruses, to bacteria, and other environmental toxins. We break down and age prematurely. So stress is actually one of the biggest contributors to illness today. Start by improving your physical health. A healthy body promotes a healthy mind. And you have a clean diet that's going to prepare your immune system for stressful times. Regular exercise is a refreshing and constructive release valve for built-up tension. Personally, I've found that enough sleep is one of the most important aspects of healthy living that boosts your ability to manage stress. Sleep deprivation can really knock you for a loop when you're facing stress. Then look at your mental and emotional health. Stress isn't just what happens to us, it's how we react to what happens to us. And how we react is controlled by our minds and our emotions. So we have to master our emotions. Don't take yourself or situations too seriously. See the humor in life. Don't imagine things to be worse than they are. Don't mentally magnify them or blow them out of proportion. Realize that bad things happen. That's going to help you handle disappointments gracefully. When a stressful situation arises, look at that as an opportunity to learn, an opportunity to test your strength. And know your limits. Don't try to control what you don't have control over. And there are other simple ways to improve your mental health. Look for ways to just reduce stressful stimulation. Avoid raucous, hopeless music, high-intensity movies, derogatory humor. Replace those with peaceful, soothing music or silence. Read a thought-provoking book. Meditate. And finally, look to your spiritual health. Realize that sin causes stress and righteousness eliminates it. A lot of the wrong kind of stress comes from preoccupation with yourself. A lot of it comes from vanity, self-love, self-concern, self-pity. That's a grievous sin. When you're stressed, you need to put those things out and get your mind on Christ and on other people. Soldiers say that you don't rise to the occasion in combat. You sink to the level of your training. We need to stay in constant spiritual training. That means always keeping God first, especially when things get tough. Maintain a right spiritual perspective. Know that God is in charge. Remember his miracles. Remember how he delivers the righteous from trial. In Matthew 11, Christ said, "Come unto me, all you that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. My yoke is easy, and my burden is light." The Apostle Paul set an amazing example here. At the end of his life, he was sitting in prison, obviously very stressful circumstances. But even in those bleak conditions, he wrote the Epistle of 2 Timothy, and it's probably his most inspiring letter. He wrote in there that all the people in the church had left him, but he said, "The Lord stood with me and strengthened me." And it was in that letter that he told Timothy, "You therefore endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ." He was quite a spiritual warrior, and he did not get stressed out despite his circumstances. In How to Be an Overcomer, Mr. Fleury wrote, "Winston Churchill told his troops to learn how to have smiles on their faces as bullets flew over their heads. Churchill knew you need calming leadership or you'll make a lot of mistakes in warfare." And then he wrote this, Paul's actions here, and he's talking about that letter of 2 Timothy. Paul's actions demonstrate what you can do if you stay with God. There isn't any reason for us to be overly stressed. Remember, When times are good, build your health, your physical, your mental and emotional and spiritual health. And then when you're in times of high stress, don't neglect those things. Take care of your body. Keep your thoughts healthy and your emotions healthy. Take care of your relationships with your family, with your friends. Keep your spiritual life healthy. That problem you're facing isn't going to get easier if you lose your health. It won't go away if you withdraw from God. Maintain your physical, your mental and emotional, and your spiritual health. And when those times of stress come, you'll be able to thrive. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on the program today to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Brent Noctegal and Daniel DeSanto. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Leo Tolstoy. If then I were asked for the most important advice I could give, that which I considered to be the most useful to the men of our country, I should simply say, in the name of God, stop a moment, cease your work, look around you. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.